AI agents are everywhere, automating tasks and making decisions at machine speed. But agents make mistakes. Just one rogue agent can do big damage before you even notice. Rubrik Agent Cloud is the only platform that helps you monitor agents, set guardrails, and rewind mistakes, so you can unleash agents, not risk. Accelerate your AI transformation at rubrik.com. That's rubrik.com.
On the Empire Podcast this week, this could be a mistake. Singing with a cold. Come with me and you'll be in a world of your imagination. As we talk to Timmy Two Meats, yes, he's back. Timothy Chalamet, star of Wonka, and he's brought the brilliant Keegan-Michael Key with him as well. Ooh. Bonanza. And Cowabunga, it's Jeff Rowe, director of Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, Mutant Mayhem, which is now out on the shiny discs and whatnot. Ooh. All that and more on the movie podcast that is currently engorged on Tom Cruise cake. If you think that's tasty, wait until you try Arnold Schwarzenegger's sausage.
Oh boy.
Hello Pod, I'm Chris Hewitt. Welcome to the Empire Podcast. And yes, it's true. We have just had a slice, well, say we, because Helen O'Hara, our geek queen, did not have a slice of this Tom Cruise cake, which he sent to us and indeed many other outlets, just to be fair, because that's how Tom rocks and rolls. And this is a cake James Dyer, a great big fucking nerd, that presumably Tom Cruise made with his own hands whilst jumping off a cliff on a motorbike.
I'm reasonably certain he bakes the corpses of his enemies into the cake.
I don't think he does.
I think he does.
I don't think he does.
As your lawyer, I'm pretty sure he doesn't.
And we should also be clear, when we say Tom Cruise cake, this is not a cake made of bits of Tom Cruise.
That we know of.
That we know of. If it is, he tastes surprisingly coconutty.
There is an article about this on the interwebs, the history of the famous Tom Cruise coconut cake, if you choose to look it up. And who was it who introduced him to? So it's a very specific bakery, isn't it, in LA that it comes from? A cake shop.
It was, yes. And it was there was a discussion between himself and two co-stars in one of his films about who knew the best cake. And both co-stars brought in a cake and this was the winner. But I can't remember the names of who it was, so that's it.
Someone quite famous, as I recall.
This is a great anecdote.
It was two famous people. It was the equivalent of like Julia Roberts and Cameron Diaz.
Right.
It wasn't them, but it was someone like that.
Julia Roberts, Diane Keaton, someone recommended to him this wonderful coconut.
So
bear in mind, coconut cake. Coconut is a very controversial choice. Like, no fucker eats the Bounty. That is a long-running joke.
That's not true.
Hey, I like a Bounty.
That's absolutely
I like
true.
A Bounty. There's no need to have, you know.
Bounty hunters, we don't need their scum.
Mutiny over Bounty.
Yeah, it is the last one eaten in my family.
It's absolutely not.
Chocolate.
But
tin of celebrations or tub of celebrations, Snickers can fuck off.
No, well, Snickers could also fuck off, but Bounty does get left behind in my family boxes, I'm just saying.
I mean, you should invite me over on Boxing Day, Helen, and I'll hoover up all the Bounties for you.
Yeah, no, probably not though.
Come on, anyway. You can hoover up the Bounty wrappers because I eat those mothers.
Fair enough. So it's an unusual, it's a controversial cake in many
unusual.
Ways. But he sends them out every year to the people he loves. To the people he loves. There's good grammar there somewhere.
He did say that on the card.
You are
the people that I love. But to be fair, he loves us the most. You know why? Because we didn't get one cake, Chris. We got two motherfucking Tom Cruise cakes. When you say we,
Nick got one and then the whole team got one.
It's socialism, Helen. What's Nick's is ours. So Nick got a personal cake and we, as Team Empire, got our own office cake.
Well, I can't wait to try it.
Well, Helen, if I get a cake, as I did last year.
You did bring me some, thank you.
Yes, you may get a cake sent to your house. Because delivered by Tom personally.
Delivered by Tom Cruise, yeah. He dangled from beneath the ceiling. I have quite low ceilings in my flat, so I was really taken by surprise. But yes, Emmanuel Béart sat next to me and put laxatives in my coffee. And I was on the toilet for some considerable time. Then it got sent to Alaska afterwards. Really, really bum deal. But hey, I hope William Donlow gets a cake. Do you think Ethan Hunt sends cakes out? You know, if he has somehow besmirched your reputation, like that poor William Donlow, Rolf Saxon, the original Mission Impossible, banished to Alaska through no fault of his own.
Some fault of his own.
What fault of his own?
Well, he should have maybe realized that, hey, if he's having to suddenly rush to the toilet, they should get someone to cover his post.
What do you mean cover his post? It's a very specialized detail that he's on. If he doesn't crunch those numbers, it won't make much of a difference.
Is this what happened to Dr. Fleischman in Northern Exposure? Is that how he got to Alaska?
I don't know. I'll ask him.
Oh, boy.
It's a good joke. See, I'm infused with the power of Cruise.
Yes.
I see.
Yes, okay. You are.
I'm going to break out Les Grossman in a second. I was going to say Len Grossman, but that's a completely different character. That's the thing. So Ethan Hunt has wronged many, many people, sometimes by shooting him in the face. Do their relatives, you know, does, for example, the widow or widower, right? Or of, I don't know, Philip Seymour Hoffman's baddie from Mission Impossible 3.
Whose name I think we all remember, but there's no need to say it right now.
Davian.
Very good.
That is good. That's right. What you know what that is actually, and this you only find this out if you get the 4K Blu-ray release, but the rabbit's fur is actually what they call the cake. 100% that's what it is.
It is a Tom Cruise.
Which is why they never show it to you in the film.
Yeah. I'm just saying, it would be nice. It would be a nice thing. You would have closure, really tasty closure. So I hope that he does that in the movies as well. Or just any movie, any Tom Cruise movie.
Mm-hmm.
That would be nice.
Would this only apply to Ethan Hunt or are all of our action heroes sending cakes to their wronged enemies?
I think you should.
Over this festive period.
You know, with a little card saying, sorry.
Yeah.
Yeah, sorry I ran over your husband or sorry I dropped a crane on him. That sort of thing.
Yeah, that sort of thing.
Like Bond should do that. Like Alec Trevelyan's partner, right?
Right.
Sorry I dropped a crane on your... on the face of your husband.
Austin Buy Powers, me a cake!
Austin Powers sending one to the Smitty family. You know.
Yeah, precisely. Yeah. That'd be nice.
That'd be lovely.
That'd be lovely. Anyway, thanks, Tom, if you're listening, and I know you are. It tastes absolutely delicious. Thank you so much indeed.
Can we stop talking about cake? It's very upsetting.
Let's stop talking about cake. And just to say as well that our integrity remains undimmed and undiminished by this lovely benevolent gesture from Tom Cruise, who, let's just remind us all, is the greatest of all of us. I believe work starts again soon on the 5-star film that is Mission Impossible, Dead Reckoning Part 2.
5 cake rating.
And I, for one, cannot wait to... just watch every single second of it.
You're an absolute disgrace. Can I just say, I got, so I'm a member of the London Film Critics Circle.
What?
As am I.
Yes.
Are you, Chris?
No, because I don't review films.
Okay.
That's true.
So as a member of the London Film Critics Circle, I got sent a sort of for your consideration thing this week, right? I got an envelope, which come all the way from the US, from a major film studio. Okay. And in that envelope... there was a thick piece of folded over cardboard of the sort that you might deliver a DVD or Blu-ray disc in, you know, to protect it from the elements.
Yeah.
But in
the
this
elephants.
Case, yeah. But in this case, it was just a folded over piece of cardboard containing nothing. And then there was a code to watch this film digitally online, which they had already emailed to us a couple of weeks ago. And this cost $18.90.
How do you know that?
Because it was on the front of the envelope.
It was.
To post from the US.
Right. This could have been a Raven mail.
This is the absolute classic, you know, meeting that could have been an email. This is the piece of cardboard that literally already was an email.
Yeah.
And for some reason, I now have to recycle.
What was the film?
I wasn't going to say.
Okay. Look, Chris, there is no way on earth either one of us are going to tell you that it's Barbie. That's just not going to happen. So just move on.
The 5-star masterpiece, it is Barbie.
It is a 5-star masterpiece. I am considering it. That's not the point. The point is, this is not an efficient use of his resources.
Do you know, the only way for me that Barbie could be improved is if Tom Cruise were in it.
He would make an excellent Ken. Which
I
Ken
think he'd
would
make
he
a great Barbie. There's nothing beyond Tom Cruise, and every slice of his cake just convinces me of that even more.
Well,
I say give him the Oscar.
You're just the integrity.
All the Oscars.
The integrity is just off the charts.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Anyway, should we take a listener question?
Let's.
All right. This one comes from Thomas Cruise Maypole IV.
And it's, how do you like my cake?
I like it a lot, Tom. I like it a lot. But not nearly as much as I like the 5-star masterpiece it is, Mission Impossible Dead Reckoning Part 2.
Oh, boy.
We got a lot of questions. A lot of them are pertaining indeed to the cake. I guess.
Oh, are they?
Did we tweet about this?
I did.
It's been on Instagram, which is how I knew you had it and asked you to bring me some, and you failed. So
we did.
Now I have to physically.
We were already
go get
en route. We were already en route.
I mean, yes, having
like,
failed to think of it,
I can run across the rooftops of London buildings.
Can you
smash my ankle?
Oh, well, I believe that bit. Yeah.
Yes, just climb, huffing and puffing. If I fell to my death, you could eat me. I hereby give you permission to eat me.
I don't think you were delicious and coconutty, if I'm honest.
I am coconutty. Tom Cruise's coconut resides in me right now.
We reviewed Candy Cane Lane last week.
We did, James, yes. You were wearing
the
blue
jumper. There is a whole plot thread in that film about Tom Cruise.
Is there?
Yeah, there really is, where the genie is obsessed with Tom Cruise. And in fact, we see his running along the rooftop.
In Candy Cane Lane? Or do you mean the genie?
Oh, genie.
Yes, that's right.
Interchangeable
yes.
Christmas movies. I'm so sorry. There is no genie in Candy Cane Lane. There's an evil elf, and the evil elf may or may not like Tom Cruise. But the genie in Genie.
I mean, the clue was very much there in the
I name. See what you're saying. Yes, it was in fact Genie. In Genie, the genie is obsessed with Tom Cruise.
I dream of Genie. Right.
Yeah, and she dreams of Tom Cruise. Yeah.
I dream of Tom Cruise and his incredible cake.
Yeah.
All right, we've got lots of questions. Lots of people going, is that cake as nice as it looks? No. It's nicer. Let me see. Which Tom Cruise cake has been the best? I would say Cake Tail was very nice.
Do you know what? It's interesting because this year's cake is an evolution.
Not even a murmur.
It is an evolution. So normally it's kind of like a round, much smaller round cake with like coconutty icing on it. This time it's a kind of bund shape with a hole in the middle and it's covered in coconut. So it's stepped up its game. And this year's
cake.
That's
the same as last year, isn't it?
Maybe that was last year, but in previous years.
Yeah, there was a layer cake element.
It was a layer cake. Coconut layer cake.
Not Matthew Vaughn's layer cake.
Yeah, exactly. There was no Daniel Craig in the middle of it. But this new bund in incarnation, I'm very much in favor of.
We had a discussion about bunts last year, you see. That's how I remember.
I see.
Anyway, either way, it's been a delicious cake when I have had the opportunity to sample it.
All right. Okay. Enough banging on about the cake. Otherwise, people will assume we've been compromised.
Yeah. It'll all go berserk on the subreddit.
Have we been compromised?
We may have been compromised.
Oh, no.
What if
initiate
it wasn't...
Initiate the ghost protocol.
What if it wasn't Tom Cruise who sent us that cake? What if it was... Dun, 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 the entity.
No!
No! Gregor Hector asks, which dead actors do you want to read you a bedtime story?
That's just creepy.
This is in reaction to the story this week that James Stewart's voice has been recreated by AI.
With
about that level of accuracy by all accounts. And is being used to sort of do one of those, you know, calm meditative app bedtime
Make
story
it stop.
Things. And apparently the estate signed off on it, which, you know, is a bare minimum, I suppose.
Were they sent a cake?
Maybe they were, and it
maybe
just compromised them. But I do feel like the...
A knock list.
This is getting very confusing. I don't feel like it's a super great idea.
It's a shitty idea for cunts.
I mean,
is what it is.
You say potato, I say potato, you know? I don't love it as a concept, and I think we should let the dead lie. Have we not seen enough zombie movies to know that bringing dead people back to life doesn't generally
end well? I want to eat your brains, Clarence! If
you're going to bring dead people to life, you ask them five questions and five questions only, and then you put them back to rest.
But do ask them the full five. Don't just leave them sitting there through the credits.
Yeah. Right, don't leave them hanging.
What five questions would you ask Jimmy Stewart?
I'd ask about working with the rabbit on Harvey.
Right, okay.
Oh, that's one question. Oh, I've got four more.
Oh, God.
I've never tried a Jimmy Stewart impression. I'm quite liking it.
Please stop.
I'm leaning into it. If anything, it's getting better.
Is it? Oh, you've got four more questions, young lady.
I don't know who he is now. Anyway. Go on, four more. Four more. Between the two of you, surely you can come up with...
I have no questions. Four more.
Oh, like,
James would be, who are you? What have I seen you in before?
I don't think I have any... I don't feel that he has a particular angle on something that I need, apart from possibly his take on your Jimmy Stewart impression, which I don't feel he'd be in favour of at all.
I think he's nailed me.
I don't think he talked much about his World War II service. I'd be interested in knowing more about that.
Do you know what? If I could resurrect anyone to read me a bedtime story, it could only be Sir Sean Connery.
Sean Connery.
Read me Charlemagne.
Oh, that'd be amazing, wouldn't it?
It would be glorious.
He could read you the novelization of Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade.
I'd
in the
love
original,
that.
In the original ancient Greek,
yes,
presumably.
In Greek. And the chair. That'd be amazing, wouldn't it? So Hell's Bells, you haven't answered the question.
I said no to it.
No, you got to answer the question. Dead person. You have rudely awakened them. You have interrupted their ancient slumber.
Like Mum-Ra, the ever-living.
Like yes. Mum-Ra, the ever-living.
Who would it be? Again, you love your old-timey black and white dead people.
I do. I mean, I'm looking, if it's going to be like reading me a story, it's got to be someone with a great voice. I'm thinking,
oh, like Jimmy Starr.
I mean, he has a great voice. You're doing it badly, but he does have a great voice. I'm thinking Richard Burton, maybe.
Well, Richard Burton,
fantastic voice. I don't know. I'm not really an Olivier fangirl.
Oh, Olivier. Have you tried acting, dear boy? What?
I'm not sure that's quite him, if I'm honest.
It's in the ballpark.
It's
in the ballpark.
Wow, I'm not sure about
it's
the
a
size.
Big park.
That's a regulation
yeah,
ballpark.
It's, a big park.
It's not so much Gilgood, more like Gilbad, but it's in there. It's in there.
I mean, Gilgood also not a bad shout.
Yes. What am I basically saying is,
but I'm going for Burton. I'm saying
you're going, you're going for Burton.
I'm going for Burton.
You're going for Burton. All right. What I'm basically saying is, why resurrect a dead star to do this when I am available? Yeah. I'm a lot cheaper.
A lot cheaper.
A lot cheaper. And crucially, a lot shitter. But oh, go to sleep now, little Timmy.
In fairness, I don't think you are shitter than an AI version of these things. So I'm gonna give you that much credit.
Oh, you can feel it. Oh, sleep taking you like a pillow over the face. Oh.
What? No.
Sleep now.
Stop it.
Everlasting sleep.
Stop it.
Forever sleep taking you to the dark horizons.
I don't like you.
Anyway, that was a good question. Well done, everybody.
Okay.
That was good.
I mean.
Yeah.
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 A dead, okay, I haven't answered it.
Okay.
A dead person with a good voice.
Yes.
A dead person with a good voice.
Oh. Marilyn Monroe's feeling.
Gilbert Godfrey.
Oh, God.
Every night, the Aristocrats, a different version.
Wait, did I just say Sophia Loren, who's not dead?
I don't think you did.
I think
but
I
if you did, then let's just we, make sure yeah. that you know she wasn't. She's still very much alive.
Very much alive.
Go to sleep!
The best part of this whole question is that Boyd Hilton legitimately listens to this podcast as he's going to sleep.
Really?
Yeah, yeah. So you can ASMR the shit out of him.
Boyd Hilton! Boyd Hilton! This is Gilbert Gottfried! Gilbert Gottfried on the Empire Podcast! You can't go to sleep right now because the mother is sucking the father. The father is climbing up a ladder and jumping off the ladder, and there's animals. Animals, Boyd Hilton. This is all your fault.
That'll do.
Oh, God.
I always, always cut Gilbert Gottfried out every time he appears in the podcast.
As you started doing it, I was like, this is really funny and no one will ever get to hear it.
I might leave that one in. I might leave just for Boyd.
Yeah.
Just for Boyd. Anyway, shall we move on? Gilbert Godfrey, there's mine. What an amazing suggestion. Thanks, yep. Jimbo. All right. If you want to have your question read out on the Empire Podcast, you can either send us cake in the form, well, not in the
yes.
shape of Tom Cruise.
Ice it. Ice your question onto a cake.
Ice send your it to question the onto a cake. And yeah, that will work. But don't lace it with drugs.
Mm. And also, if you're going to do it on a downslope. Because some motherfuckers are always trying to ice cakes uphill.
Oh, boy.
Very good. Very, very good indeed. You can get in touch with me on Twitter. I'm at Chris Hewitt. You can slide into my DMs. You can reply to a panel shout out every now and again. Or you can reply to any of my tweets once you've stopped laughing, of course.
All right. Shall we have a guest?
Who should we have?
Yes. Let's start with Timmy.
Timmy Two Meats. Wow, it's amazing. It's been a few years now since Timothy Chalamet for It Is He appeared on the Empire Podcast with Armie Hammer. And what? What? Anyway, that was for Call Me By Your Name. And that is where we kind of coined the nickname Timmy Two Meats.
Yes.
Although apparently that we didn't actually coin it in that interview. It kind of it's grown since. Its legend has only grown, Helen.
Sure.
Anyway, another thing that's only grown since then is Timothy Chalamet's career. Thank God I finished that
Thank
sentence,
God
right?
Thank God you finished that sentence.
He has gone from strength to strength, from Call Me By Your Name to Dune.
Oh no,
I walked into that one. And other films that he's been in over the last couple of years as well. And now he stars as the title character in Paul King's wonderful Wonka, which tells the story of a young Willy Wonka and how he comes to be one of the best chocolatiers, but not, crucially, a coconut caker maker.
That we know of.
This might have been his. Anyway, Timothy Chalamet is in Wonka. He is excellent, as is Keegan-Michael Key. who of course is one half of Key and Peele, one of the best sketch duos of all time, of all time. I wonder whatever became of Peele. Anyway, Key's doing pretty well for himself, and he's very, very funny in this movie as the chief of police. And the two of them were paired together, and so I went along to speak to them last week. I'm losing my voice rapidly, but hopefully I'll get to the end of this. And I had a good old natter with him about a great many things. And no, I didn't tell Timothy Chalamet about the Timmy Two Meats nickname, because he'd quite clearly forgotten it, had no idea who I was, and had security escort me from the building at his earliest convenience. It's only fair and only right.
Relatable.
Oh, here they are now, Timothy Chalamet and Keegan-Michael Key. Enjoy, you mothers.
Timothy Chalamet, Keegan-Michael Key, welcome to the Empire Podcast. How are you both?
We're doing well.
Doing great.
Yeah.
Good. I have to ask, obviously, sometimes when you talk to pairings on junkets, there's an obvious reason why you're paired.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you might be friends, you might be brothers in the movie, but you two guys, Willy Wonka and the chief of police in this movie, are adversarial. So
it's true.
Why have they put you together?
Oh, why have they put us
why
together?
Why put you together?
I don't know.
I was mulling this over in the way.
That's a really good question. Yeah. I'm stoked to be paired with Keegan because we had a great time on set, but Keegan probably makes me laugh harder than anyone I've met, besides Codes.
Codes makes you laugh.
Codes makes me laugh.
Yeah.
But, I mean, Keegan's just, if you grew up on Key and Peele, like I grew up on Key and Peele.
Yeah.
It's just, I'm very grateful to do this with you. So it might be a pain in the ass for him.
No, it's not a pain in the ass for me at all. I appreciate Timmy's, I mean, I don't know why they paired us together, but I think
appreciate
they see
my fandom.
They see what's that?
You appreciate my fandom.
What I really appreciate is your intelligence. I do. I really appreciate your intelligence, and I love spending time with you. We are friends. We are friends, which is, you know, I don't know. But I don't know that people outside of here know that about us.
This little bubble in this room.
Yeah, because when we started shooting the movie, we lived about 5 minutes away from each other.
In Camden.
In Camden Town, and spent a lot of time in Camden.
You're in Camden. Okay.
Yeah. And spent a lot of time with each other and talk about cinema and talk about art and talk about life. And you're a very considered person.
Thank you. My
mom's going to love that.
Is your mom going to like that?
My mom's going to love that. This will be the one I send to my mom.
I like the way you think, and I like the way that you put ideas together.
Thank you.
And the way that you pick your work, and I enjoy your spirit.
I really feel like I can leave at this point. This is like a lovely mutual appreciation society. Yeah,
right.
Now do me. So Timothy, obviously you're a big fan of Keegan's work. So did you ever, I mean, have you ever, would you ever, like, you know, go and give us a bit of a substitute teacher now and again? Or and how do you react if people ask you to do that?
I don't know if Tim's ever asked me that, but
substitute teacher is amazing.
I don't know if you've ever.
It's one of the greatest sketches of all time.
Yeah, I agree.
Of all time,
I agree.
But
I would do Keegan's characters to his face all day.
Yeah.
But that's a really fine line. You know, somebody was saying that to me recently. Like when you're around tremendously talented and funny people, all you really want to do is make them laugh. It's like it gives you the biggest seal of honor. And I think I make Keegan cry more than.
He definitely made me laugh. He definitely makes me laugh. He definitely makes me laugh.
So when did you first meet? Was it on the film?
We met before that.
Okay.
Did we meet on a carpet? Something? It was before SNL.
Yeah.
It was before your first SNL, because remember, but we did do that. I was going to be guest starring in a sketch on SNL when he hosted the first time.
It was a very good sketch with Cecily Tyson.
With Cecily Strong.
With Cecily Strong.
Yeah.
Cecily Tyson.
Cecily Tyson. Man. All 93 years of age. Cecily Strong. Yeah, it was.
Oh, man.
That was awesome.
That would be a crazy sketch.
That would be a crazy sketch. Oh my God. But we had a really good time. But we had met before that. I'm trying to remember where it was. And I thought to myself, this kid, because I'm a fan of his. The thing is, I mean, we're talking, and I'm just gonna say it, Tim. We're talking about our generation's James Dean. He is our generation's James Dean. And I know that's a lot to put on you, but you are. And his talent knows no bounds.
Yeah.
I'm just going to keep this mutual admiration society thing going for a little bit here. But and that's why I was so excited to make this movie with him, because it's such a departure from anything else he's done. I know that he's done a couple. I know you've done now. You've done two big commercial movies, but Dune certainly falls under the category of the other work that you've done, and this does not. And you do this with such aplomb. It's so wonderful. It's really, really wonderful.
This has been the best interview we've done all day.
It's really good. Because once we get into a podcast, once you get into a podcast, you can really just start talking any way you want.
Dropping the voice a little bit lower.
Yeah.
Yeah. I love that comparison. And it's interesting. I don't want to, you know, harp on it too much because it clearly makes you, I don't know. But James Dean obviously made only three films. But there's something about James Dean. I don't know that he could have played Willy Wonka. I genuinely don't know.
I agree, Chris. I don't think he could have played Willy Wonka. But the comparison that's interesting enough for me is that he's so different in the three films that he made.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And what you do is you
put me onto Giant.
Did you watch Giant?
Yeah.
You finally did watch Giant.
Extraordinary. Not all in one sitting, but.
No, it's a long movie. It's not a whole one sitting movie, but. The work he does in that as compared to the work he does in Rebel and East of Eden, I'm getting chills thinking about it. I'm literally getting chills on the back of my bald pate thinking about it. And but I see that the tone of this movie, you're so successful in it. It's so – you really dropped into this tone and you really dropped into the world in a way that's so different than anything else you've done. And I'm just really looking forward to people seeing him.
Absolutely.
Dancing, singing.
Yeah.
And
right from the off as well. I mean, the whole kit and caboodle. It's a musical that says from the off, this is a musical.
Yes.
We're not going to apologize for it.
Yeah, the opening number. Yeah, opening shot.
Opening number. Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And how did you dial into that? I mean, how did you dial into Willy Wonka?
Yeah, it was different. It was much, as Keegan just said, even Dune, which was this a film of the same scale that it worked on, but the tone was quite serious. I think that's one of the great appeals of that movie is that it's sci-fi, but that the human interaction in it feels quite grounded. So this was almost like something I feel like I prided myself on in my early work as an actor was to not feel the thrill of being in a movie that I felt early on was crucial to performances feeling real, because when you're in real life, you're not thrilled to be in a movie. I hope I don't sound like an idiot saying that. But, so this was really about learning to let go and just be joyful within it, because this character is. And to not be suspicious of that. And really working with Keegan and with Olivia Colman on those 2 days, that really opened me up because I respect both their work tremendously. And I just saw they were very much within a tone. It was very refreshing. It felt like I was doing stage work again or in high school, because you're very much within a story.
Yeah.
I don't know how to put it. The thing I did right before Bones and All, you know, this Luca film, we were in, you know, really remote locations in Nebraska or Ohio, or the set takes care of 80% of the, not the set, I don't want to sound cynical, but the location and the realism of it takes care of so much of the storytelling and informs so much of the tone. This was like, we are telling a story. So it's great to see Olivia and Keegan open up to that tone, being with Rowan Atkinson. And,
oh God, yeah.
Yeah, it's like, it felt like a traditional in the best way, you know?
It's like a live action cartoon, this movie.
It's like a live action cartoon. That's a really good way of putting it. Yeah. Yeah, it definitely has. It has this heightened feel about it, but it's heightened. Yet there's this cleverness that so much of it's practical. You know, for people, I'm trying not to ruin it, but I mean, like, this podcast, people will see when they will hear whenever they hear. Mm-hmm. You know, when you think about the hover chalks, I think the hover chalks are really fantastic because it's not magic that's making people fly.
Mm-hmm.
It's the fly inside the chocolate that's making people fly. Mm. And as opposed to someone like in Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, like Augustus Gloop, who gets enormous. Mm. Right, is that right?
Yeah.
Yeah, he gets enormous from that.
No. Violet Beauregard.
Yeah, Violet Beauregard gets enormous through the magic of the chocolate.
That's right.
Whereas my character gets enormous practically. Does that make sense? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
There's this wonderful practical sense about how the magic works. It's very Asgardian in a way, where they say Asgard is not magic, it's science. Mm-hmm. It's just beyond our science. And Willy's science is beyond his imaginings are beyond the imaginings of the people that he's spending time with.
Yeah.
He uplifts everybody at Scrub It and Bleachers.
Yeah.
And it's really great.
It's interesting. I've
been following Paul's career for a while now. I'm a big fan of the two Paddington movies as well. And I'm guessing that Paddington 2 in particular broke you down as human beings on a cellular level, as it did me as well. Yeah. A big reason, I'm guessing, why you signed on and wanted to work with him.
That, I just watched that again recently. It's when Aunt Lucy shows up at the end.
Oh, Jesus.
Just like, and I don't know. It's like that movie's just extraordinary.
He just puts it's how he puts the heart into the films. I mean, people talk about heartwarming films or heart wrenching films, and it's Paul's. He has this way of being simultaneously serious and dramatic and comedic all at the same time. I'm not quite sure how he does it. You come all the way for The Mighty Boosh. You think about the stuff that he did in The Mighty Boosh, and that lends itself to the fantastical. But it's how he makes the heartbeats. He makes the heartbeats of the story work, and the Paddington movies was 100%. I was just like, Paul King, perfect for this movie. And then when I heard that he wrote it, when I saw that he wrote it, and he and Simon wrote it, I went, I want to be part of this. I just want to be part of this. This is gonna be terribly clever, and it's gonna be wonderful.
Were you almost surprised that this movie has such an emotional heart as well? Because it looks amazing. It's very, very funny, but my God, by the end, I was a sodden mess.
Oh, excellent. I mean, this film.
That's a good thing.
No, thank God.
That's a very good thing.
Because,
believe me. People are very protective of this character. When things are perfectly made once, people feel skeptical about it being revisited, particularly that it's a money grab. And what you just described is exactly why this movie needs to exist, because there's a real fulcrum to it. There's a real heart underneath it. Without giving too much away, this is the story of a young man whose connection to his mother is healed and more properly formed in a healthy way through his connection to chocolate. And if someone's listening to this and raises their eyebrows and
go see the movie.
Yeah, that's what it is.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. Got to talk about the singing. Obviously, both of you are adept. You've sung before, but even so, when you're on a soundstage, Neil Hannon, who I think is a genius, by the way, a huge fan of Divine Comedy, you're singing his songs on stage for the first time. Is that a terrifying moment? Is that a freeing moment? What's it like for both of you?
I would say it's a freeing moment because, as people used to say in the world of musicals, that when you can't talk anymore, you sing, and when you can't sing anymore, you dance. And then I think that is true, and so that is what makes it freeing, is that there's this sense that I can't act this anymore this way. Yeah. I have to transfer this to something else, to something more open or more brash, or however you want to put it. And I think the singing helps. I think it helps.
Mm. Yeah. Timothy?
Agreed. It was increasingly freeing over the course of the experience. At first, it was more jarring. I feel like jarring is the right word. I don't know. Okay. It was just, I love how Keegan just put it. I wish I had that in my ear before we started, that it's sort of what needs to be communicated for your character, for the plot, can no longer be achieved through the conventions of human conversation or behavior. The best thought I had towards singing this movie was it's acting on pitch. Forward. Yeah.
That's good.
Yeah.
I wish I'd known that when I played Fagin in my high school play, Oliver. Because I would just sang. I was a dreadful, dreadful Fagin, but I just sang because it said in the script to sing. But if I'd known this.
Right.
So much better, you guys. So much better.
Yeah.
Real quick, you're surrounded by sweets and chocolate. Yes. Is that anathema to actors? I mean, can you partake of this stuff, or is it just there to torture you?
No, I think this is real.
Yeah.
I think this is real.
But can you partake? Because, you have to do movies and.
Oh, you mean can you partake in regard to our physiques?
Yeah, your physiques. You gotta keep this.
You gotta go try to keep it. Try to keep it right and tight. Scramble it up.
On that note, Keegan, Timothy, it's been a pleasure. Thanks so much,
Chris.
AI agents are everywhere, automating tasks and making decisions at machine speed, but agents make mistakes. Just one rogue agent can do big damage before you even notice. Rubrik Agent Cloud is the only platform that helps you monitor agents, set guardrails, and rewind mistakes, so you can unleash agents, not risk. Accelerate your AI transformation at Rubrik.com. That's Rubrik.com.
Okay, that was Timothy Chalamet and Keegan-Michael Key, and Wonka is out right now in cinemas, and we will be reviewing it. I'll be just basically lavishing praise on it in a few minutes' time, later on in the show. Right, time for some movie news. What has been happening in the world of movie news? I'll tell you what's been happening.
Yeah.
Movie news. But should we talk about, there's been some trailers,
one of which hit,
I think, just after we recorded last week's episode.
You must have been furious. Or Furiosa.
And it is, of course, George Miller's Furiosa, a Mad Max saga, to give it its new official name. The trailer for this, Anya Taylor-Joy as a young Furiosa, Chris Hemsworth as a character who some speculate might turn out to be the bullet farmer, who we see in Mad Max Fury Road.
I wondered the same thing because of the moment in the trailer where he is almost literally being swamped in bullets. It seemed like there was an association deliberately being drawn there. Who knows?
Quite possibly. And lots of vehicular mayhem. So I thought this looked good. Mm. I thought it looked great. I thought it looked fantastic. And then Twitter was like, meh.
Ugh, fuck
really?
Twitter.
A lot of Twitter was like, the effects are unfinished. And it doesn't look as good as this one.
It is Miller time and I'm 100% here for it. This was so much fun. I'm so excited about this.
It looked of a piece with Fury Road, and yet not. It looked like a step onwards from it at the same time. Mm. I'm super hyped actually. I feel like I don't know what Chris Hemsworth's performance is going to be like over the course of a film. It's big, certainly, but I'm really glad for him that he's getting to do weird shit like this. You know, he feels like a guy who has been constrained by his own good looks, forced into heroic roles.
I know exactly how
you must. Of course, you guys. You guys would
plagues us as well.
That.
Quite often, we get together, the Chris's, and we lament. We lament
your own perfectly chiseled features. Mm-hmm. But it feels like, you know, this is him kind of swinging for the fences, and I hope that ends up cool. And Anya Taylor-Joy, always great, always great.
A joy,
in fact.
Yeah. Did you enjoy it, Chris? Were you fully rictus erectus?
I beg your pardon. That's a very, very personal question. I do not wish to respond to it. It looks great. Looks fantastic. The action looks wild. The filming of this, I don't think, was as
fraught,
shall we say, as the making of Fury Road. Hopefully this time George Miller had two leads who actually got on. That would be nice, wouldn't it?
Hey, they ended up friends afterwards, just not maybe during.
That's what they tell us, and that's what I choose to believe. Helen, by the way.
Yeah.
I have a bridge for sale. Would you be interested in it?
Hey, look, I'm an optimist. It wasn't the only gigantic film to get a trailer this week, because of course, Godzilla X Kong.
Yes,
the
also
collab.
Got a trailer.
It's not just Godzilla X Kong. It's
Godzilla X Kong : The New Empire.
The New Empire. I like this tradition now. Two films coming out next year.
Name
the word Empire.
Mm. Mm.
Yeah, Frozen Empire, the Ghostbusters movie, and now this. I don't know.
I think it's a message to the universe, isn't it?
This is something Tom Cruise could get on board with. You know, maybe Dead Reckoning Part 2, because there's been talk that might be renamed. Mm. Sorry, I don't know what I was thinking. The five-star masterpiece that is Dead Reckoning Part 2 might be renamed, Coconut Empire.
Yeah, Coconut Empire.
Empire of Cake. I don't know. All I know is masterpiece. Anyway, Helen, you were saying about a film that hasn't said it's any cake, and so therefore it's on the fence.
Wow, okay. okay. Well, what appears to be happening, and honestly, I find this trailer a little confusing, and I'm not 100% sure, but Godzilla and Kong have to team up against baddie giant apes?
Yes.
So it's kind of beneath the planet of the apes, if the apes were the size of the Empire State Building.
Yeah.
Kind of a thing.
Maybe.
Possibly. Plus Godzilla.
It's very hard to tell.
But Godzilla has pink spines now and looks a bit rock and roll.
What's up with that?
I love it. I don't know, but I'm embracing the 80s neon, and obviously so is he.
I've been watching some Monarch.
Legacy of Monsters,
which is the TV spin-off, and I'm quite enjoying that. I don't really understand everything that's happening there either, but I'm here to find out more. Yeah. So, look, I mean, you can't really go wrong with a giant lizard stomping things?
You can, and they have spectacularly.
Okay, yes, they have.
Right. Yeah.
But like, you know, right now or coming up soon in cinemas, we've got Godzilla Minus One, which we'll probably be talking about in the next week or two. Mm. So it's a good time to be a giant monster, you know, stomping around the screen, hopefully.
Although the trailer does end with the two of them running in slow motion.
Yeah.
And Kong runs a little bit like Phoebe from Friends. I'm just going to leave
that there. Oh, that's not fair. Also, did you notice the prosthetic arm?
Yes. Well,
I thought it was more of a glove.
Is it a glove? Is it like an Iron Man gauntlet thing?
It's like something he's wearing on his arm. RSI.
Yeah. I wasn't sure.
That's it.
All right.
That's it.
Well, that's good then.
Yeah.
He's got carpal tunnel.
Yes. So Adam Wingard is directing this once again after Godzilla versus Kong, which is good. Rebecca Hall is back as insert name of character Rebecca Hall played in the last movie.
Dr.
here.
Eileen Andrews?
Who can forget Dr. Eileen Andrews, who was incredibly well fleshed out in a three-dimensional character?
I mean, yes. This is, again, you've seen these films, right? Like, when is the last time we had any well-fleshed out human character in these films?
Yeah. I feel it's weird that it seems like they took all of the characterization from those films and just dropped them into Monarch. And that's just where they keep it, like a special draw.
Yeah, it does kind of seem that way.
Is it good, Monarch? Is it good, that show?
I'm having fun.
Yeah.
I think the first episode definitely is a little bit slow. It seems to get very bogged down in exposition, but it picks up after that.
Yeah. All right. I'm having fun right now.
Yeah.
Dan Stevens is in that, which is good to see. Yeah. Reunited with Adam Wingard after The Guest. Hopefully he plays a similarly psychopathic individual. That would be nice. And they get to stare at the big monsters. But yes, that shot of the two of them running in tandem is one of the most stupid things I've ever seen. And I am very, very,
10
very...
10 out of 10, absolutely. Love it. Yeah.
Yeah.
They was running.
They was indeed. So yeah, I'm excited about that. Mm. Cake or no cake?
Wow, you're so generous there. Keep an open mind.
I wouldn't want a cake baked by Godzilla or Kong.
No, that's fair. Although Kong could, like, you know, he could be sort of radiated on his atomic breath. You know, so he could cook a lot of cakes at once, is what I'm saying.
Jesus, imagine a Hollywood handshake. Imagine that. Imagine Paul Hollywood giving them a handshake. They did rip his arm off.
That'd be terrible.
That would be terrible.
There was also the trailer this week for Bob Marley, One Love, which is Kingsley Benadir playing.
Kingsley Sir Benadir. Actually, Helen, I think you find.
Is that right? Okay, well, it's an interesting one. I feel like most of the film is here in the trailer. I feel like we get quite a lot of the story.
I hope the film would be longer.
I imagine it is a bit longer. I'm just saying quite a lot of the story beats are kind of here in the trailer. But, you know, it looks, I'll be honest, it looks like a biopic, but it's got a really good cast, and I don't know much actually about Bob Marley's life, so I look forward to finding out more and then falling down a, you know, Wikipedia rabbit hole afterwards and trying to find out what was actually true and what was actually not true in the biopic, as is the way of these things.
Apparently he didn't fight at Waterloo. He didn't even try to take Egypt. Can you imagine?
Killed a man in World War II.
Yes.
Stabbed him in the back.
True. Just to watch him die.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. Well, anyway, Lashana Lynch is in it as well. James Norton, Michael Ward, Michael Gandolfini. Good people. So
good people. Good people indeed. All right, that'll be out
early next year.
Jimbo, do you have any movie news that you'd like to...
I normally avoid all TV news because I like to say things for the Pilot TV podcast, but there are two things that I'm going to mention on Pilot, but I feel the need to mention them here as well. And they are, in many ways, Christmas presents. There is a gift for you, Chris, and a gift for you, Helen.
Hurrah!
And the gift for you, Chris, is that Reacher, which is arriving very, very soon with its second season, has been renewed for a third season.
Squee!
We will be reviewing Reacher on the next Pilot Plus because it is embargoed. It's not on the regular Pilot podcast. And Helen, what else has been renewed but Foundation, which is coming back for a third season. Woo-hoo. I am here for it.
I'm very excited.
Yes.
Season 2 was amazing.
Wasn't it?
This is exciting news. Exciting news. They have picked up Lee Pace.
Very good.
I said very good. I got in ahead of you. Praise myself before you guys... You could get in there and do it for me. I just assumed it was praise coming.
Right.
Sure.
So I decided to add my voice to yours. My voice is really going, by the way. There's a really good chance that people might finally get their wish and I might be mute by the end of this podcast.
Excellent.
Probably doing Gilbert Gottfried wasn't the best idea.
In retrospect, perhaps.
In retrospect, not the best idea, but hey-ho. Reacher, very excited about this. Alan Ritchson, who is the professional name of Jack Reacher, who is, of course has become an actor and stars in Reacher as himself, but claims to be this actor called Alan Ritchson, did a video from Instagram this week, where he was on set of Reacher Season 3, which is pretty bold, given that Reacher Season 2 hasn't come out yet. But, you know, they're very, very confident about this. Reacher Season 2 is based on Bad Luck and Trouble, book 11 in the Lee Child series.
I think we all know that off the top
of
our heads.
We all know that. Mm-hmm. But I interviewed Lee Child recently, not for the podcast, and I tried to get him to tell me what season three was based on. And he saw my tricky line of questioning coming and wouldn't fold, sadly. But what Reacher book would you like to see them adapt for season three? Bearing in mind that it's probably too late to change it now.
I think they should do what they should have done for the second season and go with Die Trying. Like, why break the canonical order? Like, absolutely do it.
It doesn't matter about the order.
Chris, of course it matters. There's form to these things. There's a canonical order. You should not deviate from it. Uh-huh. I will say, and I have seen all of season two of Reacher, and I'm not going to review it, not least of all because it's embargoed. I do think it is an unusual choice to pick Bad Luck and Trouble for the second season, given that the whole thing with Reacher is he's the lone guy who wanders into town and causes chaos. And Child broke that formula for this book, but had obviously done many books leading up to it. It's an odd thing to switch up the formula for the second season and have him with his team. I would not personally have done it that way. I'd be fascinated to know what Nick Santorum did, you know, what the thinking was behind that.
Here's the thing. I read the first, I don't know, what was it, 16, 17 books in a row.
In an afternoon.
Well, I mean, in a few weeks. So I don't know any
don't
of
know.
Them apart.
Oh, well, Helen.
I just read them
obviously,
all.
We start off with Killing Floor.
No, please don't do this.
Then we move swiftly on to Die Trying.
I thought you had
then
a lot to do today.
Then there's Tripwire. And then
Hook
book
Hobie.
Four.
Love Hook Hobie.
Oh, the Tripwire, of course, is the one where Reacher stops a
yes,
bullet with
his chest
muscles.
It's amazing.
In fairness, he does end up in hospital in a coma for about 2 weeks afterwards. But still, it would have killed a normal man. Book four, of course, is The Visitor, which has another name, Running Blind, I think, in the States.
Yes, that's right, in the States, of course. Yeah. And that's a weird one because that's another strange, because it's a serial killer story.
It's
not a regular one.
Yeah.
That's a weird one. And also, that's that
like
weird
that
phase where Reacher is no longer roaming the land. He's got a house and everything.
Bring,
it doesn't
bring,
last long.
Bring, bring.
But
hello? Oh, okay. Sorry, that was all the listeners saying, please save this for your Reacher podcast.
It's true.
The Reacher
we should
round.
Save it for the Reacher rounds.
But true. But that's asked Jimmy Stewart, but he thinks of Jack Reacher.
Jack Reacher, I will sure be delighted to come back from the dead and read some of those fantastic books, starting with book five, Echo Burning.
No,
then
please,
I can move on to book
please.
Six without fail. Then
you were the one who was busy this
book
afternoon.
Book seven would be... Persuader, Brooke, he's gone. To, where's he from now? Brooke, hey, wee, yeah, Gee Willikers.
I don't know what's happening.
What's book eight?
I think he's turning into Yosemite Sam. I'm not sure.
Book eight is one where Jack Reacher is killed. He is stabbed in the back by Christopher Lee.
Christopher Lee could never. Christopher Lee could never.
I mean, at least they'd be on an eye level. You
yeah.
Know?
And roughly the same height.
Anyway, book eight is, as we all know, listen, I'm committed to this now. Book eight
you
is
cannot list
book
them all.
Eight is I think it's the hard way. I think it's the
it
hard
certainly
way.
Feels
no,
like it.
No, it's the first prequel. It's the first prequel. Haha, fuck you. It's the enemy. Book nine is one shot. Book
Stop.
10 is the hard way. Book 11 is Bad Luck and Trouble. Book 12 is the terrible one where he walks back and forth between two towns
hope, and,
hope
despair.
And despair.
Yes.
And it's called Nothing to Lose. Book 13, my first Jack Reacher book, is Gone Tomorrow. Book 14 is 61 Hours. Book 15 is A Wanted Man. Book 16 is another origin one.
Did I buy you
Gone
Tomorrow?
The Affair. No, I bought it in the airport.
Are you sure?
I texted you going, hey, what is this Jack Reacher thing like? And you were like, you will not regret it. And then it was like crack into my veins after that point. Book 17. No, book. I'm so sorry. I misspoke. Book 15 is Worth Dying For. What the fuck was I thinking? Book 16 is The Affair. Book 17 is A Wanted Man. And then there are other books that come after that.
Oh, thank God.
Book 18 is Never Go Back. Book 19 is Personal. Book 20 is Make Me. And then there are other books.
I will make you. Stop.
Yes. All right. I'm excited about it. I would go for 61 Hours or Gone Tomorrow. I would bring Reacher to New York.
Never go okay. back, Chris. Never go back.
Never go back. Or anyway.
Helen, what's next on the movie news front?
Dear God.
There's not a huge amount else,
I
would
say. There's a lot of TV news.
But we don't need to.
Sorry, Helen. I've crossed the streams.
Eli Roth has announced that he's working on a Thanksgiving sequel.
That's exciting.
So that's a thing that's happening.
That's exciting.
I actually still haven't seen Thanksgiving, much to my disappointment, but I will get around to
Neither
it at some
I.
point.
Nor have I, sadly.
So,
but I hear good things, actually.
Yeah, me too.
I do hear good things.
And then there's the news that Ryan Reynolds and Channing Tatum are teaming up for an action comedy. Which I believe is called Calamity Hustle.
What's
that?
Feels like a That feels like a, you know, you've gone on the internet and there's like a generator for, generate me a kind of noughties action comedy title.
Yeah, but it's not bad as those titles go. It's not like, you know, dead, you know, peril or something. Do you know what I mean? Like, it's not just too boring words, it's two fun words put together.
Yeah, but I think if you're going to do one, like, at least do something fun, like Shanghai Noon, like, you know, push the boat out a little
bit. Calamity Hustle isn't bad. I'm just hoping one of them has the surname Jane, for example, you know? That would work. But anyway.
And the other one has the surname Flo.
Well, the problem is they're actually brothers, apparently, I think.
So probably the same surname.
Yeah, it's a former LA detective turned private investigator who's shaken down by a crime lord and has to track down his estranged brother who interfered with a diamond heist. So presumably, one is Ryan Reynolds, the other is Channing Tatum. And I kind of feel like both of these guys are very fun on screen.
Yes.
They've got similar enough energy that I would absolutely buy them as family. I think this could be really fun. I think this could be good. Don't you?
It could be good.
Am I the only one who's excited here? I feel like this is
excitement's a strong word. Okay, I'm not writing it off.
Vaguely excited. It sounds like it could be fun.
But yeah, it's happening. Apparently, it's writer-directors Aaron and Adam Nee who worked on The Lost City with Tatum.
Okay, yeah, no, that's interesting.
So that was fun.
I like the Calamity Hustle reminds me of the alternate title for the Alan Partridge movie, which obviously they went with Alpha Papa. Mm. But there was another trailer in which they went through different
Colossal
titles.
Velocity.
Colossal Velocity.
That's a great title. I don't know why they went with Alpha Papa, because Colossal Velocity is a much better title.
I honestly think, I think that Alpha Papa is a fine title, but yes, Colossal Velocity is definitely what they should have gone with.
Okay.
All right. Well, that seems to be it. As far as we can tell, no major movie news has dropped otherwise, and nobody, as far as we can tell, has carked it. So, should we move on?
All right.
To the second of this week's guests.
Hurrah.
Who is Jeff Rowe.
Whoa.
Who is the director of Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles Mutant Mayhem. But wait, Chris, I hear you cry. Didn't I come out in the cinemas ages ago, you absolute melon? Yes, it did. But there's such a thing as home entertainment, shiny discs, digital downloads, streaming, you know, all the good stuff. And so it is out now. And it's one of the best animated movies of the year, Hellspells, I would say.
I would agree.
Yep. We have actually done the spoiler special on that as well, which will be going up in the spoiler special feed as soon as I get it finished. But Hells, you actually took the lead on that one, didn't you?
Yes, I did. That's right. I forgot.
Yeah. Because I was otherwise engaged.
You were.
Dead.
Pretty much dead to the world. But no, it was a really fun discussion because basically we all loved it. Which is not to say we would have excluded any haterators that we could find, but we couldn't find any because you know why? It's freaking great.
Anyway, it is out right now for you to listen to, as is this interview in which Ben Travis, mega Turtles fan, sat down and chatted about all things Turtles and other things as well with Jeff Rowe. Do please enjoy.
I am thrilled to welcome to the Empire Podcast the director of Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles Mutant Mayhem, Jeff Rowe. How are you doing, man?
I'm doing good. How are you?
Yeah, I'm great. We're in London. You're in town. How come you're here?
I am here for this interview. I traveled across the seas and time to speak with you today.
I love that. We threw up the turtle signal. You saw it from the US and you were like, I have to be there. We appreciate that dedication.
Oh, I have to go to London. Oh, sorry. no, I love it. I love it here. This is amazing.
Yeah. And we love the film. The film is an absolute blast. I guess I want to start this by talking a little bit about the music because it strikes me, you've got an incredible soundtrack for this film, and it feels like a stealth way that you know that young audiences are going to see this film, and at an early age, you can introduce them to the musical stylings of Old Dirty Bastard, Shimmy Shimmy Ya. He famously said Wu-Tang is for the children. You took that literally. You have an ODB needle drop in this film.
Absolutely. No, yeah. And I think that was a, I think there was like a discussion also where it's like when he's saying, ooh, baby, I like it raw. Like, is that, can we put that in a family film? Will that get past the censors? There was a lot of discussion about it. It could refer to many things.
A diet,
a picture format file for digital photos. We don't really know what ODB meant. So you can draw your own conclusions. But yeah, the music was a big part in shaping the identity of the movie early on. For me, it was a way to evoke the 90s and evoke nostalgia without the film having to actually be set in the 90s. It could still be a contemporary film. And I just started putting 90s hip hop tracks that I love to the movie in early versions, like De La Soul and KMD. And it just fit really well with the tone that we were crafting.
And then does it come to a point where you're like, I don't want to change these songs? Do you have to go to Paramount? Do you have to go to Seth Rogen and Evan Goldberg, your producers, and say, we need these songs. What can you do? What's the process from there?
Yeah, I mean, it's like, you know, I think there was a lot of back and forth about, because, you know, licensing songs is it's an expensive part of the movie making process. And we had a lot of songs, and there was some negotiation about how many could we have and which ones we had to have, and we had to be really, really focused on that. Like No Diggity was one of those ones that were like, we cannot put another song to this scene. It works so well. People love that scene, and we're like, whatever that is, we have to find a way to make that one work, and we're willing to sacrifice other darlings to save that.
I mean, I'm going to come back to the feel of the film and the look of the film, but I just want to talk about, I mean, we're a couple of months now removed from the film coming out. How are you feeling now in this moment, knowing that people really clicked with this film because you have a sort of slightly different take on the turtles? They are defiantly teenaged turtles, kind of for the first time. You have this very distinctive art style. How does it feel to you knowing that people got your iteration of turtles, got the look of the film, that people really clicked with that?
It's good. It's you know, like, we were kind of like the art team and I and all the wonderful people who worked on the film took a lot of big swings visually, stylistically, just in the storytelling. We always tried to do a lot of things that aren't typically done in animation, and it's anxiety inducing. You know, it's like, we like this, we think this is cool, but will the world like it? Will people appreciate it? We really didn't know. We had a hunch, we had a hope, but to see it go out there and have people actually respond to the art style and get it and see and say back the things that we would say about it was just so rewarding and validating.
Yeah. What's been your favorite thing that you've seen out in the world, or your favorite reaction to the movie now that you released it and people make it their own, people latch onto these films? Have you seen a particular reaction or something that somebody has made in response to this film that has particularly hit you?
There was one podcast that did a deep dive on it that I was like, oh, I love this so much. They really get it, and I cannot remember the name of it. I'll have to look that up. Like, the fan art is always really cool to see. I think I'm hearing a lot of people are dressing as the characters for Halloween, which nice. Is a thing I did as a kid. So it's like, I love Halloween, love costumes, happy to see this inspire a new generation of Turtles fans. And my dream is to see like a really good Superfly costume. I want someone to put a lot of work into one. We will retweet it. We will celebrate you if you make a really good one. Please, I hope that's in the works, someone in the world.
And if you make it, it has to look authentically wonky. It has to be like paper mache.
Yes.
It's got to have like those big hairs sticking out of it. You have to have maybe even go for the horse leg variant at the end of the film if we're veering towards spoilers.
Never in my wildest dreams could there be a super duper fly costume, but that would be that. I mean, I think that's the holy grail.
You have to see as well if you inspire a generation of kids once again to take up like martial arts classes. I spoke to Seth and Evan for the magazine. Seth talking about how it made him want to take up kung fu, and then he immediately got nunchucks and smashed a massive lampshade in his parents' house with the nunchucks right in front of Evan. So we're waiting to see if a generation of kids take up nunchucks after this movie.
I hope they do or don't. Be safe, people. Don't. I hope it. More so than anything, I hope it lets people feel comfortable being weird. Like so I think the Ninja Turtles when I was young shaped my sense of humor and shaped my artistic taste a little bit, and I would love for this version and it's just overt strangeness to similarly color a generation of artistic taste.
Yeah, I mean, let's talk about the art style. Let's talk about the animation because it is so distinctive. This is an incredible looking film. And right when we first got our very first glimpse at the trailers and what you were doing with the kind of scribbly art style, that slightly almost claymation texture of the characters as well, you're doing something really bold and interesting here. I guess in a general sense, what is it like for you to be part of this? I mean, this year in particular has been incredible for animation, but to be part of this really quite rapidly evolving landscape of people pushing those boundaries, and for you not just to be part of that, but to have your own very distinctive style with this film in kind of pushing that outwards.
Yeah, I think it's a really exciting time to be making animation. I think studios are seeing a unique visual style as an asset to a film now and its marketability instead of a risk, which means that hopefully within the next decade, you know, like there were a lot of comparisons made between our film and Spider-Verse, which was always not frustrating because it's you know it's a beautiful film and I appreciate. Please compare my movie to another great movie. But they look so different. They're stylistically, they're so visually different from each other. And I think we're just at a point where this is still so new that the vocabulary isn't out there to talk about the differences in style. And my hope is that in the next decade, there are so many different looks to an animated film that things kind of shift to being filmmaker and artist driven like they are in live action where it's like, oh, Roger Deakins shot that film or, oh, that's edited like a Martin Scorsese film. I can recognize the fingerprints. Like it would be nice to see that level of authorship and kind of undiluted expression come through in animation.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, how would you describe the look of this film? What is it to you that defines the look of Mutant Mayhem?
The very simple math equation is it's like teenage drawings. The kind of sketches you do when you're 16 and you don't have formal art training or a voice in your head that tells you like, hey, that's not how you draw. You're just like putting lines down with like passion and feeling and not really caring about the end result. So it's like that plus the street photography of Alex Webb and these like bold saturated colors, high contrast. It kind of has a very unique lighting style for an animated film. And it also kind of looks like a oil painting, which we did, which wasn't necessarily intentional, but when we started seeing it, we're like, wow, this is beautiful. This is part of the look now.
Yeah. Yeah. It's an incredible mix of visual styles. And what was it like for you moderating from shot to shot? Because there are certain shots where you really lean into the pencil textures. There are certain shots where you're not leaning into that as much. It's like whatever the shot needs, whatever the scene needs, reflects which part of the art style you're kind of leaning towards. So how do you moderate that from moment to moment in the story?
I think it's it's not. I approved, like personally approved every shot in the film, which sometimes doesn't happen. Sometimes it's the director will just approve key shots, and then the production designer will handle the shots in between. But me and Yashar Kasai, our production designer, personally approved everything, and Yashar would often do digital paintings on top of frames of the film for hundreds and hundreds of shots in the movie, and it really gave him a lot of influence over that consistency. Like at the end of the day, anything that seemed like it wasn't going to come from Yashar would paint and kind of put it into his own voice and style, and we're fortunate because it makes as you say, it makes things that could be disconcertingly different feel cohesive.
You worked on The Mitchells versus the Machines. You were co-director on Mitchells versus the Machines. What was the biggest challenge on this versus that film? Because that's another film that has a very bold, distinctive look in this kind of recent influx of really artistically fascinating animation.
Yeah, I think like it the technology evolves so rapidly, and I think with Mitchell's, their Spider-Verse was being made at the same time, and that was kind of the only thing that we had to go off of, and we worked with Sony Pictures Imageworks, and we were able to use a lot of that technology, but Mike and I were maybe a little bit timid. We were first time directors, and there was a lot of questions around like, well, can we do this? Is this possible? And people would be like, ooh, lying around a character, that's really hard. And we'd be like, okay. So yeah, we'll use that sparingly. And then going into this film, I was like, I know exactly what's technically possible and what isn't, and I know what we can push on. And it just gave me the confidence to push things even further than we had on the last film. But that was a masterclass in learning how to direct and see a film through an entire pipeline, and would not have been able to do this without that experience.
And in terms of the challenges of this film as well, you have massive fight scenes that you're delivering in this art style. So what was the challenge? What was the joy of getting to, you know, choreograph and create these incredible dynamic fight scenes with the four Ninja Turtles, and then also be able to interpret that action in this art style?
Yeah, I mean, that was a question that I had a real conversation with Seth Rogen at one point where I was like, I want to do some like crazy color lighting things at some point in this film. Do you think that's going to make things less funny? Do you think it'll be too visually distracting? And he was just like, no. In my experience, you can light things however you want. It actually doesn't matter. If something's funny, it'll still be funny. He referenced there's like a whole blacklight scene in Neighbors. I think this was around the time that we're like, I want to make the bowling alley blacklight because that'll look cool. Is that going to be okay? And it ended up being fine. I mean, I think as far as the action goes, we favored, we don't have a lot of quick cuts. There's a lot of thinking about the chop shop. There's a lot of like tracking shots that connect characters. So it makes it easier to, on a technical level, follow the action and maintain silhouettes. And you don't have to get a new read and reorient yourself geographically as an audience member on every cut. I think ultimately if anything, it forced us to be more considerate of every shot and make sure the action was reading, because we knew that we were going to do this kind of like intense lighting and color on top of it. So we had to be really precise about every decision that we were making. And I think it helps. That process and that focus and attention, I think, helped the action play.
Yeah, I mean, the action sequences are so exciting. Are you talking about everything that you learned on Mitchell's then plays into this? At the end of this film, you have a pretty big tease for a sequel. What do you want to do next? What could you take everything you've learned on this and put into the next film? And is that, are you looking for that to be a Turtles sequel?
Yeah, I think you know, so it's like I am we're in the early stages of developing a second Turtles movie. It's happening. We have to live up to the promise of that very exciting tease. But I think anytime you do the same thing over and over again, it begins to feel stale. Like, I have so much respect for artists who you do one thing really well and then you just completely pivot and do something different. We're in London. It's like Radiohead doing OK Computer, and then now we're doing Kid A, and this will be jarring to many people. But even like, you know, Alien to Aliens, like it's an effective sequel because it doesn't try to be the first film. One is a slow boil horror film. The other is a blockbuster action film. You change the genre. I think what I've learned is that to make a successful sequel to this film is we have to do something bold and different. And it's the thing that'll make it exciting. So fill in your own blanks as to what that's going to mean.
Kid A meets Aliens. Kid Aliens.
Yeah, perfect. You got it. There we go.
No pressure. No pressure at all. Well, thank you so much for coming in. Great to speak to you. Thanks, Jeff.
Of course. Thank you.
Okay, that was Jeff Rowe, and Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles Mutant Mayhem is out right now, folks. Run highly to your nearest digital store, or indeed an actual physical store, and pick up a DVD or a Blu-ray version.
Amen.
Absolutely. And the Spoiler Special interview, which is a very different thing, will also be up very, very soon as well. Very exciting time right now. A lot of good stuff coming your way. A lot of good stuff coming your way. Just in time for Christmas, of course. And just in time for Christmas, they have released Wonka. Wonka!
Hurrah!
The Paul King directed prequel to the Mel Stewart 1971 movie Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory, which starred Gene Wilder as Roald Dahl's chocolatier, Willy Wonka. This one, of course, stars Timmy Toomeats, as we have already established, but also this one has an all-star cast. Calla Lane, a newcomer, is in it as a young character called Noodle. You have Keegan-Michael Key, you have Olivia Colman, you have Hugh Grant as the Oompa Loompa. Who else is in this movie? Hell's Bells.
You've got Patterson Joseph, Matthew Bainton, Matt Lucas, who play a trio of evil chocolatier cartel members. A
friend of the Pilot TV podcast, Big Tom Davis.
Yes, Rowan Atkinson is in it as well.
This is, as I said, directed by Paul King, written by Simon Farnaby, and yes, they are the same duo who delivered Paddington 2 to us, and also Paddington, but, you know, everyone loves Paddington 2 in particular. And this movie was written off, Helen, it was written off by and large by a lot of people when it was first announced, a prequel to Wonka with music, with songs. This is never going to work. But you write off Paul King at your peril, don't you?
You do, you do. And look, I said I have my reservations about prequels, as you know, but I have no reservations whatsoever about Paul King. When the trailer came out, I was like, you know what? Nobody was excited by the trailer for Paddington either. This is not proof of failure. And right enough, I had the biggest grin on my face throughout this film. I was so utterly charmed by it. I cannot even express it. I was giddy. I just loved it. But yes, it is Chalamet as Willy Wonka coming into town with a hat full of dreams. First of the songs, all of which I thought were pretty solid. And
pretty solid.
Okay, great.
Neil Hannon.
Great. All right.
Pretty solid. Touched by genius is what I think you meant to say.
Sure. Anyway, comes into town, rolls up against Dickensian hard times, frankly, has to struggle his way back to the top through a series of madcap and faintly magical schemes. Has a lovely relationship with Noodle, with Calla Lane's character. He sort of becomes a bit of a mentor for, and a, certainly a partner in crime, if you like, for. You have kind of pantomime villainy from Big Tom Davis and Olivia Colman, yep. And also the three chocolatiers. You just have so much silliness and fun and light and sweetness and joy and, you know, like I say, really, okay, fine, great songs, beautiful dance numbers. Really loved the design of this city that they're in. Basically, I think Paul King he's gone with, on one hand, it's very Parisian. On the other hand, it's very German. He's just taken buildings anytime I was looking at a sort of sky view of the city, there were buildings that seemed to be, I was like, well, that looks like Venice, that looks like Prague, that looks like Paris, that looks like, you know, wherever else. So I thought that was really, really clever. They've really seamlessly woven together real location shoots with studio work, with CG environments. They have the funniest Oompa Loompa ever. I thought Hugh Grant was absolutely hilarious in this. There has been a criticism that this Willy Wonka isn't dark enough. I very much disagree with that. First of all, Willy Wonka is meant to have become paranoid because people kept trying to break into his factory and steal his stuff. So it doesn't make sense that if he started out that way, there would be no arc for him to then be redeemed by Charlie somewhat. Second of all, I'll be honest with you, Gene Wilder was never my Willy Wonka. I had read the book like, I don't know, 10 times by the time I saw the film. And I was like, no.
That's what? Not right.
I'm sorry. That's just, I read the book first.
You get
that's
nothing.
That's not the vision in my head.
How I also have problems with that film.
In my head, Willy Wonka was
Jimmy Stewart.
Uncaring of the kids getting into trouble,
yeah.
But not actively malignant in right. a way that Gene Wilder sometimes is.
Yeah.
And so he was almost more distracted and more like, that's not important, but it wasn't. He wasn't actively hoping that they would fail. I felt anyway. And maybe I was reading it as a very young child, but that's what was in my head.
Because there is a villainous feel to him in that.
Yeah.
Which is absent in this film.
It is absent, but I think it makes sense if he's meant to have become darker over time and then he's meant to be redeemed. It doesn't make sense if he starts off wreathed in darkness. So that was fine with me. I didn't have a problem. I didn't need him to be darker than he is. I love that. My tiniest of notes are some people aren't going to like it because they have no joy and warmth in their hearts. So if that's
I'm
not,
right
if
here,
that's
Helen.
You, well, I mean, we'll get to you in a minute, I'm sure. And that's fine. It's not going to be for absolutely everybody. And I didn't love the Irish accent that one character did. Other than that, I just adored this with all my heart.
Interesting. Jimbo?
You would expect me to hate this film. I know you would. And yet, it's delightful. Some great performances in there. Really, really funny moments. It's quite heartwarming. It has this sort of magical fairy tale feel to it. You know, the city, you know, his vision of it is almost like a convention in and of itself. Like, it feels like almost like a chocolate paradise. It's kind of sweet and it's wonderful. Patterson Joseph, who plays sort of the leader of the trio of chocolatiers, is fantastic. He's great
they're
in all things.
Wonderful.
Yeah, yes, they are. I really liked it. I don't think I was as up on the musical numbers as you guys were. Like, a couple of bangers in there, but the singing I could have done without in large part. But I thought it was lovely. I thought he was great. And I really enjoyed the fact that the central relationship, if there can be said to be be one, is between Willy and Noodle. And there's there's not a love interest, and it's not that kind of story.
No, not at all.
It's about friendship and bonding with people and like togetherness and closeness. And, you know, it is Christmas. It's a time of miracles. And these are the themes we should be embracing.
Yeah, it's two lost children, really, kind of banding together.
100%.
There's nothing creepy or weird about that friendship at all. I thought it was miraculously beautiful.
It is joyous.
I think they've done it again, to be quite frank with you. This is very much following the Paddington formula. We'll get into it more. We're doing a spoiler special where I interviewed Paul King and Simon Farnaby about the movie. For me, it's absolutely magical what they've done. I think it is for me, on a par with the Paddington films. I think it's very much off that formula. Yeah. It is about someone who comes to the big city from the tropical jungles. He's been on a bit of an exploration, a bit of an adventure, and lights people up with the magic and just the sheer warmth of his heart. But there's a lot of other things going on here as well. Visually stunning, as Helen said. Every scene has a giggle involved, but it also has such a huge heart. And for me, there was, you know, a development towards the end of the movie that genuinely I was very, very glad that the lights stayed on after the film ended for the credits, because sometimes they turn the lights up for critic screenings. I was a bit of a sodden mess at the end of this. You know, I still think they're probably... Happy Birthday, Aunt Lucy is the absolute apex of making people cry in these films, but there's an emotional climax to this movie that is just absolutely beautiful. Songs are great, but I was kind of always in the tank for the songs, because it's Neil Hannon, who is effectively the Divine Comedy, and he is a genius, and the songs here are so catchy, and it is so unashamedly, unabashedly a musical. The trailer, as most trailers for musicals do, went out of its way to hide that. But the first 30 seconds of the movie, Timmy Two Meats bursts into song. There's a great song that introduces it. There's songs all the way through. They're so catchy. I was walking around Sainsbury's the other day singing the first song from the movie. Timmy Two Meats is great in this. It is absolutely filled with joy. For me, it's a 5-star film. For me, it's made a very, very late, very, very late break for the number one spot on my Films of the Year list. That is how much I love this movie. When have I ever steered you wrong? Shut up. Don't mention that film. Anyway, we gave this one 4 stars. I think I would happily give it 5.
I would too.
I've seen it a couple of times, and I'm very much looking forward to seeing it again. And Little Drinking Game loved it as well. It was her first proper experience of a live-action movie that A, didn't bore her, or B, didn't make her want to walk out.
Yeah, I'm planning to take my small niece and nephew this Christmas, I hope, because I just came out and wanted to share it with all my loved ones immediately.
Yep, I hope it is a hit. I hope it is a big, old, fat, chocolatey hit. 4 stars then for Wonka. Also out this week in cinemas, but then it'll be out on Netflix as well in the coming weeks, is another kiddie-friendly movie, and it is Chicken Run, Dawn of the Nugget. Hell's Bells, let's stick with you for this one.
Okay.
This is Aardman, this is Peter Lord and Sam Fell returning to the 2000 movie, Chicken Run. Mel Gibson was unavailable for this one and so has not returned to voice Rocky. More controversially, Julia Sawala has not returned as Ginger.
No.
Who's voicing her in this one then?
That's Tendiwe Newton.
Okay.
Who does a very good job and sounds actually quite a lot like the original voice performance of Ginger. I would suggest respectfully, with nothing against her performance, which is totally fine, that you should have stuck with the horse that brung you, if I'm honest, for that role. Because I don't think you particularly gain any movie star, you know, power from the decision. But both of the newcomers do a perfectly good job. They are also joined by Bella Ramsey as Molly, who is their little chick, their daughter, who now joins them. They've been living on that island we saw at the end of Chicken Run for a while now. They have settled down. They have had this chick. She's grown up into sort of teenager, and she has never left the island. She doesn't know about the outside world. So there are going to be, you won't be surprised to know, some lessons to learn about what's out there. And around them are kind of most of the original cast is back. You know, David Bradley's there. Jane Horrocks is there. And you've got people in there like Ramesh Ranganathan and Daniel Mays. Really, really good cast. Basically, the idea is that Molly goes off on her own, gets herself into a bit of trouble, ends up in a sort of indoor chicken farm / Bond villain lair where she's trying to rescue the chickens that are in there, and in particular a new friend that she's made, and also her parents and their friends are coming to try and rescue her. So you've got two sort of slightly missions at cross purposes going on in this vast industrial complex, and some very familiar villains, or one very familiar villain, back to face them once again.
Gromit.
Gromit is never a villain. How actually dare you, sir? How dare you? It is, of course, Mrs. Tweedy, voiced by Miranda Richardson. Look, I really enjoyed this. I thought it takes a little minute to get going. You have to give it a little bit of a bit of time to kind of set up this world, to get everybody into position. Because, of course, having escaped from essentially their stalag at the end of the last film, you have to sort of explain why anybody would end up in such dire straits again. But once it gets going, it's a lot of fun because they have managed to make it feel a bit Mission Impossible-y. I mean, deliberately and very markedly so on a couple of occasions. They have also given it its own energy, its own kind of purpose, with all of that kind of Bond villain trimming on the escape plan. So it does feel good that way. I didn't instantly love it. It's not up there with the very best of Aardman for me. It's not up there with the Wallace and Gromits. But then I didn't feel that way about the first Chicken Run either. So maybe I'm wrong on that.
All right. Interesting. Does it address at any point mm-hmm. that the average lifespan of a domestic chicken is 5 to 10 years?
I don't think it's meant to be set in the present day. So I don't think it has to. You monster.
Just saying.
Monster.
Just saying. Although plasticine chickens.
Well, this
now
is
you're
it.
Talking. This is different.
This is different.
This is very, very different. I've eaten at a few establishments over the years where the chicken may well have been made out of plasticine, to be honest.
And was certainly older than 5 to 10 years.
Yes, like the one that we went to for my birthday a couple of years ago, Jim, which we shall not name.
Never speak of that.
Which made a dramatic and sudden reappearance. For all of us.
Oh, all of us. Oh, yeah. Boy.
Oh. All right, so what do we give this one?
We give this 4 stars.
Four stars?
It is very funny again. It's silly, it's witty. That's what John said. Silly, witty, and extremely British, which I think is true. Hmm. He's also called it a good egg.
I see what he did there. That was Jesus Christ.
But I did have a lovely time watching it, you know. It's just, like I say, I'm grading on a curve here. It's to say it's not up there with the top Aardman films is no great criticism.
All right. Okay. So 4 stars then for Chicken Run Dawn of the Nugget. Jimbo, on Netflix right now. No animation in this one. Not even a really good feel-good message. This is Leave the World Behind. Jimbo does not look happy.
I left the world behind to watch this one last night, unfortunately. This is written and directed by Sam Esmail, who most people remember from Mr. Robot. He's adapted the novel by Rahman Alam. And it stars Julia Roberts as Amanda and Ethan Hawke as her husband, Clay. And they wake up one morning. She's decided they're going to take a trip to Long Island. So she's rented an Airbnb and they hit the road with their 2 children. They have a 13-year-old daughter and they have a son who's about 17. And they head off as a family to go and stay in this lovely little house way out on Long Island in the woods. They are there. They are having a nice evening in. And there is a knock at the door. And at the door...
A knock at the door of the cabin
in the woods, yes. And if you're wondering whether this is Knock Off Shyamalan, you are not far wrong. But it's Mahershala Ali, who was originally going to be Denzel Washington until he left the project. And he is the owner of the house they have rented. And he has turned up with his daughter, Ruth. And they would like to stay there is a blackout in the city. They can't get back to the city. All seems a bit dodgy. Julia Roberts' character, Amanda, is very mistrustful of them. She doesn't like them coming in. She's a very prickly, spiky, quite unhappy person. And it probably doesn't help that Mahershala Ali's character, his daughter, is also prickly and spiky and quite rude. So there's lots and lots of friction there. And you're thinking, oh, is he a bit shifty? What's going on? It emerges that things are going on in the kind of, shall we say, apocalyptic vein. And I really, 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 really want to talk about all the things that happen. But I feel it would be doing a disservice to you, because I think the joy of this film, if joy can be said to exist in this film, is... that when you get in there, that, you know, that Shyamalan feeling you get when you watch one of his films, where you don't really know what's going on, but good God, you want to know. Like, you really want to know what's happening. This has that. At the beginning, it really kind of, well, for me anyway, it really hooked me. I was like, I must know what's going on. And, you know, all I knew about this going in was that Netflix had won a bidding war, the novel was really big, and lots of people wanted to do it. Roberts produces it. Denzel Washington was going to produce it before he left the project. And you really want to know what's happening. The problem is, I don't know what Esmail is doing, but it comes off as feeling like Poundland Shyamalan. Like, it's like he throws everything at this. Like, think of something weird and apocalyptic that may or may not have appeared in a previous Shyamalan film, and he chucks it into this. There's an incident on a beach. They don't get old, but there is an oil tanker. There's an incident involving a lot of deer. There are drones. There's all sorts of things happening. And it all feels like a bit of a jumbled mess of ideas that don't really sort of cohere together. And I think the biggest problem of this, and this is the thing where Shyamalan always sort of nails it, no matter how weird and wonderful his films are, he generally sticks to landing. Like, he makes the endings work. They're often surprising, not always, but they're always kind of satisfying. The ending of this film is absolutely fucking baffling. And this film is 2 hours and 20 minutes long.
And
it doesn't need to be. It's very flabby. There's a whole sequence where they're dancing to fucking vinyl in the basement. And it's just like, I don't know why this sequence is happening. But it feels like they really, really couldn't work out how to end this. They have deviated from the plot of the book in the last act for reasons I don't quite understand. And I think, you know, and I can't speak for Esmail, but it feels like he was very proud of himself for how he ended this film. And I would argue he maybe shouldn't have been, because it made me very, very, very cross. So it's a really unsatisfying, very irritating ending to quite a long film. But there are some good ideas in here. It is deeply, deeply weird. There's some crazy camera angles in this, and the score is slightly weird as well. I kind of, even like, we gave this 2 stars, and I absolutely endorse that review rating. But I also think it's on Netflix. If you're in, maybe watch it anyway. Not because it's good, but just because it's kind of interesting. And like I say, at the beginning, there's something quite grabby about it. It just doesn't sort of pay off at the end. So it's an interesting thought experiment, which doesn't really work. But, you know, if you've got 2.5 hours, give it a go.
Yeah, I'm kind of with you on this one, Jimbo.
I wasn't bored for most of it. I genuinely was really hooked by it. But so many things happen in it that are so deeply stupid. And so many of the ideas feel at odds with each other and don't really. And that's the other thing. It doesn't make a lot of sense. And then there's also stupid people being deeply stupid, which is also very, very annoying. Like, if they behaved in intelligent, you know, relatable ways, that's one thing, but they kind of don't, and that's aggravating as well. So I definitely think it's a failed experiment, but
yeah. Yeah, lots to admire about it.
Yeah, it's not the end of the world.
It's not the end of the world. Yeah, it's got a really good opening scene, and yeah, it didn't work for me.
But I'm glad I watched it.
But weirdly, Boyd really loves it.
He did. And he mentioned
Wake up, Boyd.
On the Pilot TV podcast last week, he mentioned it, that it would be up my alley because it contains references to both Friends and The West Wing.
Oh my God.
Why was Boyd talking about a film on the Pilot TV podcast?
He does it a lot. It's very weird. It's very unsettling.
Outrageous.
Yeah.
I mean, we did just talk about TV shows though. So.
Yes, but that's...
It's all right, Boyd. You can go back to sleep. We'll stop talking about you now.
Yes, that's totally fine. All right. So we gave this one 2 stars. The World Behind.
Sounds like the rejected title for a Bond film, doesn't it?
It does.
Or it could be a reacher.
Oh, like book 21, Night School, or book 22.
Oh, boy.
This is where I get a bit wobbly.
What number was The Affair?
16.
Was it 16?
Yeah.
That's the one that contains General James Dyer.
It does. It also contains a lovemaking scene where Reacher and his lady friend reach climax as a train shudders past.
Oh, that's lovely.
Yeah.
Metaphors, who needs them? Yeah. Subtext is for cowards.
Yes. They were thrown out of Disneyland soon after. Hells Bells, do you want to say something else?
They're also out this week is Your Christmas or Mine Too.
Oh.
Yeah.
Okay.
So,
yeah, good.
I don't know if you remember Your Christmas or Mine last year, which was where Asa Butterfield and Cora Kirk playing young lovers independently, just after going to their respective trains home for Christmas from London, decide, you know what, I'm going to surprise my partner and jump on their train instead. Unfortunately, both of them do it at the same time.
Ugh.
And the trains are crowded, so they don't realize. And they both end up at their respective family homes, but without their partner. Nightmare for Christmas. So that was quite, I thought, an elegant conceit and worked quite well. This one has to belabor the point a little bit just to kind of create some tension this time. But basically, this time, both families go on holiday to Austria to go skiing. One, of course, has booked a very fancy, expensive hotel. The other one has booked an incredibly dodgy-looking Airbnb. And wouldn't you know it, they get mixed up and end up in the wrong places.
Oh, no!
I know. So it's a little bit more belabored, but the characters are still quite likable, and it's a very good cast. Daniel Mays again.
Daniel Mays again.
Mays
to December.
But yeah, not maybe quite as good as the first, but you know, Christmas films are graded on a different scale anyway.
Well, speaking of, there's one Christmas film I wanted to ask you about, Family Switch.
Yeah, I'll be honest. So this came out last week on Netflix. I am obviously, by the way, you know, recording Bah Humbug these
not right
days.
Now.
Not right this second, obviously. I'm here recording Empire, but
that'd
I am doing Bah Humbug. You're both going to help me this year. It's going to be fantastic.
We're like elves. Apparently,
you are very
I'm talking
much
about
like elves.
A Batman movie.
You are. You're going to talk about Merry Little Batman with me, which is out this week. So we could maybe mention that now. Merry Little Batman is on Prime. It's animated. It features Luke Wilson as Batman, with young Damian Wayne left at home to defend the manor against all manner of villains. It's kind of fun. It's not my favorite style of animation, but I had fun, and I think you won't hate it.
All right. Family Switch.
Family Switch came out last week, and basically, yes, the parents of a family get swapped with their teenage children. The baby gets swapped with the dog, mentally speaking, which I feel like the film could make more of. And they all have essentially meetings or auditions or college interviews or big games that could change their lives during the sort of day and a half when this is in effect. I'll be honest, I thought this was perfectly fine if you want a bog standard studio comedy, because Ed Helms and Jennifer Garner, who play the parents, could do this in their sleep. I thought the teenage actors were fine as well. The baby and the dog were a baby and a dog. You know, what are you going to do? Rita Moreno plays the vaguely witchy, vaguely angelic sort of tarot card reader who possibly makes all this happen. My issue with this film is it's the most synthetic Christmas film. There is absolutely no need for this film to involve Christmas in any way. It's like someone had a script and they were just like, can we make it a Christmas movie? And someone went, right. Yeah, we don't even have to change anything. The magic doesn't have anything to do with Christmas. The deadline isn't anything to do with Christmas. It's about a, you know, conjunction of planets or something. It isn't a Christmas movie. It just has a bunch of Christmas trees sometimes in it. So, and all of these key meetings that they're all having are on Christmas Eve. I know Americans work until the last minute, but come on, guys. So, yeah, it's fine,
you
but it's not a Christmas movie.
This.
I do kind of say Bah Humbug. That will not be on Bah Humbug this year.
It's not as good as the greatest Christmas movie of all time.
Die Hard.
Oh, I love it.
I'm sure he would.
Two stars then, or one star, or stars. Just throw stars.
I mean, it's honestly like a 2.5 star. If you're in a mood to do nothing, The Family Switch will be fine for you. By the way, can I say Wonka isn't a Christmas movie, but I am covering it on Bah Humbug because Christmas lives in its heart all
it does.
Year round.
Paddington and Paddington 2 are not Christmas movies either, but they are. They totally are.
Yep.
I'm beginning to think Paul King may be Father Christmas.
I wouldn't argue with that.
Yeah, he doesn't have a beard.
Well, for years, I believed that Terry Pratchett was Santa Claus, so, you know.
Well, that's just stupid.
No, I mean, has a beard, has a distinctive hat.
He'd be the Hogfather, Helen.
Yeah, he was the Hogfather also. I'm just saying, it's the same guy. Anyway.
Reacher would make a great Santa Claus.
He literally owns nothing but a folding toothbrush. He'd be a terrible Santa Claus.
Santa Claus doesn't own, he gives away.
Mm.
Yeah, but he has to have stuff to give away.
The elves make the stuff.
Yeah.
Rachel just has to loom over them and keep them working.
Yeah. It would make the height differential, it would be absolutely emphasized if you went to the North Pole.
Imagine Rachel
slayed nothing. Come on. Come on.
Imagine Rachel is standing next to Hugh Grant's Oompa Loompa. You know, that's the kind of height difference we're talking about here.
It would be a one-sided fight. Let's put it that way. Anyway.
In fact, he does fight someone very short in, is it 61 hours?
Yes. Which of course
he fights him in a bunker where the ceiling's low, where he has to be on all fours because the odds were evened.
The odds were evened. And I can see now why they don't want to make that one. Yeah. Anyway, on that note, that is pretty much it for this week's Empire Podcast, except for one thing. I completely forgot to plug episode 600. The ticket sales for that have gone really, really well. kingsplace.co.uk. So well, in fact, we have opened up the balcony to people who can sit above us and judge us from on high. And at time of recording, there are about 40 tickets remaining for the whole thing. The whole thing. Highly to kingsplace.co.uk. The podcast happens on Saturday, January 20th at King's Place in London. It is going to be absolutely amazing. Who knows? Maybe Jimmy Stewart will show up do an appearance. Or if you're particularly naughty, Gilbert Gottfried. It's going to be a lot of fun. So go along and buy tickets for that if you can. And then hopefully we're going to be putting streaming tickets on sale as well. Maybe the side of Christmas. You shall see how that goes. But very, very exciting stuff indeed. Anyway, that is it for this week's Empire Podcast. Join us next week for more film-related fun. We'll be joined by... Well, this is exciting. Bradley Cooper.
Ooh.
And Carey Mulligan, the director and stars of Maestro. Leonard Bernstein. It's going to be absolutely amazing. Well, it is amazing because I've done it already and they were very, very good. I wasn't amazing. They were amazing. I was pretty good.
I'm glad Carey Mulligan was amazing. But of course, if she hadn't been, she could have just done it over.
It's a golf joke. None of us play golf, do we?
I play golf.
Oh, you play golf.
You do not.
I do. I play golf.
Really?
Yeah, I do. Remember he went
with
that
who
thing
and
to...
when?
There's a golf range on Greenwich Peninsula.
Oh, someone say range?
Oh, God.
Oh,
I was on a range when I shot Liberty Phalanx.
Can I go now?
Are you sure?
No. Where's the other fellow? Anyway, yes. So... we'll be joined by Lem, and I believe, if everything goes according to plan, we'll be joined by Mark Wahlberg and Michelle Monaghan. It's exciting, isn't it?
Great.
I can ask her by facing off against Owen Davian.
You can.
In Mission Impossible 3. Sorry.
Cake.
The five-star masterpiece that is Mission Impossible 3. And anyway, on that note, until then, until we meet again, until that auspicious occasion, it is goodbye for my two colleagues of such lethal caking, Helen O'Hara.
I haven't even had any cake yet. What if it's all gone by the time we get to the office?
It won't be. They're not all gluttons. I'm here. James
I know,
is here.
I have
your
three
cake
slices.
Is safe.
What if they've
three.
Opened it to the building?
James Dyer, goodbye.
Goodbye. Guess who we got on the Ballot TV podcast this week, Chris?
Oh, okay. You,
Tom Cruise's cake maker.
Is it Daniel Mays?
No, it is Leslie Manville and Imelda Staunton. We have an entirely royal lineup.
That's exciting. From The Crown, season 6.
That's right.
Yeah. Imelda Staunton, of course, a wife of Jim Carter.
Yeah.
Who is in Wonka.
Yes, he is.
And who I once saw on a plane with the cast of the Downton Abbey.
Of the Downton Abbey. And he was reading
a Jack Reacher book.
He was.
Wow, I don't remember which one
around.
It was. I think it was A Wanted Man.
It's very sad because Imelda Staunton froze before it reached the first marker.
Oh. I mean, I guess it's kind of a seasonal joke.
Oh my God. I thought she smelled bad on the outside. By the way, we should absolutely make it clear, Imelda Staunton smells delightful. Delightful.
Oh boy.
Thanks for listening.
Oh boy.
See you next time. Bye.